You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process. This is Lecture 8, entitled What the Art of Healing Can Gain from the Spiritual Scientific Perspective, Part 2, given in Arnhem on July 21st, 1924. In the introductory lecture yesterday, I attempted to explain how the mode of cognition cultivated by anthroposophy permits a clear understanding of the human being as a total being of body, soul, and spirit. I also attempted to show you how keeping this totality in mind leads to inner insight into healthy and diseased states in the human being. By recognizing the real connections between the activity taking place in the human being and the processes and relationships between substances in the natural world outside, we also bridge the gap between diagnosis and treatment. Today, as we continue, we will be concerned with firming up the details of what I said last time in general terms. We will need to understand clearly that both degenerative and regenerative processes are always present in the human organism. As I said in the last lecture, we must distinguish between several different human, in quotes, bodies. The first of them is the physical human organism that is perceptible to our outer senses. Our reason grasps this, its manifestations through sense perceptions. In addition to this physical body, as I described last time, we must also recognize the first supra-sensible human body, the etheric body or life body. These two members of the total human being regenerate the human organization. The physical body is constantly discharging and renewing its substances. We gain an idea of the overall constitution of the etheric body, which includes forces of growth and nutrition, by considering the growing, blooming world of plants in spring. Because each plant, like each human being, has an etheric body, or life body. In these two members of the human organization, therefore, progressive regenerative development occurs. As a sentient being, the human being also has an astral body. Please do not take offense at these terms. We simply need to be aware of what they represent. In essence, the astral body transmits sensations and supports our inward feeling nature. The astral body comprises degenerative rather than regenerative forces and constantly breaks down the burgeoning growth that takes place as a result of the etheric body, or whatever you choose to call it. Soul spiritual activity is possible in the human organization only because the physical etheric factor is constantly being broken down. It is quite wrong to think that the soul spiritual aspect of the human being exists because of the regenerative process, or that this process culminates in the vehicle of our soul spiritual aspect, in the nervous system or the like. That is not the case. All indications suggest that if our profoundly admirable scientific investigations continue on their present path, they will soon discover that the essential aspect of the nerve principle is not a regenerative process. The regenerative process is present in our nervous organization only to the extent that it enables nerves to exist at all. The nerve process as such is slowly but constantly disintegrating or breaking down. The dissolution of the physical element makes room for the soul and spirit, as it were. This is also true of the actual I-being, which elevates the human being above the level of all the other creatures in our natural surroundings. Essentially, the I-organization is always engaged in a breakdown process. It asserts itself most strongly wherever breakdown occurs in the human being. Thus, when we explore the wonderful internal structure of the human organism, we discover not only a generative and regenerative process in each individual organ, an activity that serves the organ's growth and continued development, but also a degenerative process that reverses physical development but makes it possible for the soul spiritual element to find its place within the human being. I said last time that the specific balance between regeneration and degeneration in each human organ can become disturbed. When regeneration becomes overwhelming, diseased conditions result. Initially, I need to present these ideas on a somewhat abstract level, but they will become more concrete as we continue. When we choose this approach to what transpires inside the human being, we must proceed conscientiously and with a strong sense of scientific responsibility. If we really study each organ individually, and with all the conscientiousness we have learned from our natural scientific observations, which have reached such a high degree of perfection in modern times, we will not talk of regeneration and degeneration in general terms, but will be able to see the specific state of balance required in each individual organ. We will understand the specifics of health in a human being. Any disturbance in an organ's balance in the direction of either regeneration or degeneration is a pathological phenomenon in the human organism. We must also consider the relationship between the human organism and the natural world that surrounds us, because we must derive our remedies from the three kingdoms of nature, the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms. Our overview of states of balance within the human being reveals that the human organism overcomes everything that exists outside it in the three kingdoms of nature. Let's take a very simple example, such as states of warmth within the human organism. No external warmth is allowed to persist unchanged in the interior of the human organism. By tracing the course of warmth in the natural world outside, I learn that it raises the temperature of objects in the outer world. Warmth permeates these objects. If our human organization were similarly permeated with warmth, if we were just another object as far as warmth is concerned, this warmth would make us sick. If we are to be healthy, the quality and intensity of our organization must permit us to transform external warmth into internal processes as soon as it affects us. External warmth or cold immediately becomes harmful if it takes hold of us and we cannot assimilate it. It is easy for anyone to recognize that this statement is true of warmth and cold, but it also applies to all other natural processes. Only careful study, enhanced by a spiritual perspective, shows us that each force in the natural world is transformed or metamorphosed within the human organism. Our internal organization constantly overcomes our earthly surroundings. If we look at our internal organism as a whole, we see that when our internal capacity for transforming external processes that constantly influence us from outside, parenthesis when we take in food, to give another example, diminishes, anything we take in enters as a foreign body, until ultimately we fill up with foreign bodies or foreign processes. In the opposite case, when our higher organizational members, which I have called the astral body and the I-being, develop excessively, the outer processes entering us from our surroundings are transformed to a greater than optimal extent and are speeded up. When external nature is taken beyond the human level, too strongly spiritualized, to use a popular expression, disturbances in health occur once again. I have just described an abstract principle that must be studied with regard to each specific organ. Our ways of metamorphosing external processes are really very complicated. Modern anatomical and physiological studies of corpses or cases of disease view the human organism as a dead structure. When we first attempt to transcend the level of our scientific education and see the human organism as a living, active being, we find ourselves quite helpless, because the more details we learn about the structure and functioning of the human being on the level of life, the more complicated it seems. There are guidelines, however, that can help us find our way through this labyrinth. At this point, let me interject a comment that is both personal and wholly relevant. I spent 30 years searching for guidelines for understanding the overall organization of the human body before I first spoke publicly on the subject around 1917. Footnote C, title Riddles of the Soul, Collected Works, Volume 21, end of footnote. As a relatively young man in my early 20s, I pondered the question of whether certain guidelines could be applied to the study of this complicated human form in order to arrive at an overview of sorts. As I said, I was involved in this work for 30 years, before it became evident to me that there were three distinct aspects of our human organization: the sensory nervous system, the rhythmic system, and the metabolic limb system. All the parts of the so-called sensory nervous system form a coherent whole that supports all our conceptual activity. Another relatively self-contained system is our rhythmical organization, which includes the rhythms of respiration and blood circulation, the rhythm of sleeping and waking, and many other rhythmic functions in the human body. It first occurred to me to subdivide the human being in this way when I learned to distinguish correctly and precisely between the rhythmic system and the sensory nervous system. At that time, almost 40 years ago, when the basic questions of physiology weighed more heavily on people's minds than they do today, I was forced to confront the question of whether the empirical evidence really suggests that our entire soul life of thinking, feeling, and willing is bound to the system of nerves and senses. For me, this line of thought resulted in an impossible contradiction. How could thinking, feeling, and willing possibly all be bound to the sensory nervous system? I cannot present all of my thoughts on this subject in detail today, of course, so I will simply point you in the right direction. Much of this will become clear when we begin to talk about therapy. For example, precise, unbiased physiological investigations of how music affects the human organism, specifically studies of the close association between musical experience and the rhythmic element, and of the psychological or emotional aspects of experiencing melody and harmony, reveal that human emotional activity is experienced in the rhythmic system and is not directly bound to the nervous system. When we realize that our direct experience of music and the resulting feelings are supported by the nervous system only after we have raised them to the level of mental images, we discover that the nervous and rhythmic systems are inherently different on the organizational level. If you take advantage of everything modern physiology has to offer with regard to how the human ear perceives musical sounds, you will realize that audible stimuli, that is, sense perceptions of a particular type, are incorporated first into the human rhythmic system and then make their way rhythmically up into our sensory organization and finally to the nervous system, where they assume the form of mental images. Our emotional life is directly connected to the rhythmic system, but only indirectly to the nervous system, the vehicle of thinking. The nervous system is the vehicle of feeling only to the extent that we become aware of our feelings in the form of thoughts, since thoughts are supported by the nervous system. We make similar progress in studying the physiology of the metabolic limb system. If you find it paradoxical to associate metabolism with the limbs, simply consider how all motor activity, all movement of the limbs, works back on metabolism. The metabolic limb system is indeed a cohesive whole. When we study the issues precisely, rather than in some confused way, it becomes evident that the metabolic limb system directly supports all will phenomena in the human being. We have already established that there is a direct connection between the metabolism and the rhythmic system in our human organization. When will activity in the metabolic limb system works its way upward into the rhythmic system, it is transformed into feeling. Our feelings develop directly in our will, which is played out in metabolic processes. We experience or feel our will indirectly in the rhythmic system. And we develop thoughts about our will when the metabolic and rhythmic systems work strongly up into the sensory nervous system. This insight into the subdivision of the human being provides real guidelines for clearly understanding the organization of the human being. If we clearly understand the character of the sensory nervous system and compare it with that of the metabolic limb system, parenthesis, for the moment we will consider the rhythmic system as an intermediate element, close parenthesis, we find that the sensory nervous and the metabolic limb systems are polar opposites. Where the metabolic limb system causes regeneration, the sensory nervous system causes degeneration. A clear understanding of this view of the human organism shows us that the entire eye organization is closely bound to the sensory nervous system, while the entire human etheric body is more closely bound to the metabolic limb system and the astral body to the rhythmic system. The physical body pervades our human organization, but is constantly being overcome by its three other members. Having understood this, we also begin to understand so-called normal and abnormal processes within the human organism. Before we consider one of these three members, the sensory nervous system, in detail, I would like to make comment to ensure that I won't be misunderstood. A particularly malicious research scientist, who happened to hear a superficial account of my basic subdivision of the human constitution, said that I had attempted to distinguish between the head, the chest, and the abdomen. That is, that I had concentrated the sensory nervous system in the head, the rhythmic system in the chest, and the metabolic limb system in the abdomen. This oversimplification is, of course, the result of ill will. It is true that the human sensory nervous system is located primarily in the head, but it is also found in both of the other systems. The rhythmic system is indeed concentrated mainly in the torso, but it too is spread out over the entire human being. Similarly, the metabolic system can also be found throughout the human body. The issue here is not to distinguish between spatially separate organ systems, but to recognize the qualitative aspect that is active in the individual organs and permeates them. When we study our sensory nervous system from this perspective, we find that it extends throughout the human organism. Our eyes and ears, however, are formed so as to incorporate the sensory nervous system to the greatest extent, the rhythmic system to a lesser extent, and the metabolic system to a still lesser extent. Although an organ such as the kidney contains less of the sensory nervous system and more of the rhythmic and metabolic systems than an eye or an ear, it nonetheless contains a part of the sensory nervous system and includes all three members of our human makeup. We do not truly understand the human body if we describe it as having senses here and digestive organs there. That is not the case. The reality of the situation is totally different. A sense organ is only primarily a sense organ, in a certain sense. It is also a digestive organ and a rhythmic organ. An organ such as the kidney or the liver is only predominantly an organ of elimination or digestion. It is also a sense organ, although to a lesser extent. When we consider our entire human organization and its individual specialized organs, from the perspective of the sensory nervous system, from the perspective of the real state of affairs, that is, and not according to the often bizarre concepts of physiology, we discover that while the outer world is perceived by means of specific organs of sight, smell, hearing, and so on, the sensory system actually pervades the human body. On a very subtle level, the kidney, for example, perceives what is going on in digestion and elimination. The liver is also a sense organ in a certain respect, while the heart is an internal sense organ to a very great extent and is only comprehensible when seen as such. Please do not imagine that I want to criticize contemporary science in any way. I fully acknowledge all its accomplishments, and I want our view to be firmly rooted in science. We must realize, however, that modern science is not yet capable of precisely understanding the nature of the human being. If it were, it would not associate the organization of the animal body so closely with that of the human body. With regard to sensory activity, the makeup of the animal is on a lower level than that of the human being. Because the human sensory nervous system is linked to the eye organization, capital I, while that of animals is linked only to the astral body, sensory activity is totally different in humans than it is in animals. In an animal, the process of visual perception pervades the entire body, as is evident on closer examination of the structure of the animal eye, EYE. In humans, sensory perception remains concentrated on the surface or periphery to a much greater extent. Subtle structures in the eyes of animals, which are usually present only on the etheric level in higher animals, suggest that sensory perception penetrates animals more deeply than humans. In the eyes of certain lower animals, we find structures such as the xiphoid cartilage, also present in etheric form in higher animals, or the pecten, footnote pecten, resembling a comb, is a folded, vascular, pigmented membrane that projects into the vitreous humor of the eye of a bird or reptile. Xiphoid cartilage, or process, is the posterior and lowest division of the human sternum, remaining somewhat cartilaginous throughout life. End of footnote. The degree of blood perfusion in these organs shows that the animal eye participates in the animal's overall structure to a considerable extent, while the human sensory nervous system relates to the total body in a very different way. Human beings live in the outer world to a much greater extent than animals, who tend to live more within themselves. Everything mediated by the higher spiritual members of the human being and manifesting a sensory nervous activity through the capital I organization takes place in the domain of the physical body and therefore needs to be influenced, even on a material level, by the sense-perceptible physical world. An exact study of the well-functioning, completely healthy human sensory nervous system reveals that it depends on a particular substance and the activity inherent in it. As I have said, a substance is never merely matter at rest, but is actually the material representation of a process. A quartz crystal, for example, appears as a delineated form with fixed contours only because we never see it as a process, albeit one that occurs very slowly. It is important to penetrate ever deeper into the human organism to understand such interactions. As I described before, physical substances that enter the organism from outside must be absorbed and overcome by the organism. It is especially interesting to note that, in its so-called normal, healthy state, relatively speaking, of course, the human sensory nervous system depends on a subtle process influenced by silica entering the organism. When silica, which takes the form of beautiful quartz crystals in the natural world outside us, is internalized and overcome by our human organization, it is characteristically incorporated into the nervous processes. Spiritual perception of the activity of the human sensory nervous system reveals a wonderfully subtle process at work in the substance silica. Considering what I said earlier about how the human being is, quote, all sense organ, close quote, the activity of silica is simply more intense on the periphery of the human body, where the senses are concentrated, and less intense or more dilute in the interior of the organism, in the lungs, liver, and kidneys, only to intensify again in our bones. This perception reveals a curious subdivision of the human being. We have the periphery or surface of the body, where our senses are concentrated, the bones that support our limbs, and between them the muscular and glandular systems and central structures and organs specific but generally weaker in the intervening area. As we move toward the surface of the body, where the nervous system reaches into the sense organs, we need more and more silica. As we move from the periphery toward the interior, we need relatively less silica. But in the bones that support our motor system, we need more of it again. This perception of our entire human organization shows us how a particular specialized process, such as the activity of silica, takes place inside the human being. Having recognized this process, we begin to realize how imprecise modern physiology is. As I have said, my intention here is not to criticize, but simply to state the facts. Let's take respiration as an example of how contemporary physiology studies human life. In some respects, respiration is a complex process, but it consists essentially of taking in oxygen from the air outside us when we inhale and giving off carbon dioxide when we exhale. Human life on the organic level is based on this rhythmical process. Physiology describes how the oxygen moves through the body, combines with carbon from our blood, and is eliminated in the form of carbon dioxide when we exhale. From a superficial perspective, this description is accurate, but in reality, the combining of oxygen and carbon is associated with another process. It is not true that we simply inhale oxygen and combine it with carbon inside the body. That is what we do mainly with the oxygen that we distribute throughout the lower part of our bodies. There, oxygen is indeed combined with carbon and exhaled in the form of carbon dioxide. This rhythmical process, however, is underlaid by a different and subtler process in which the oxygen that moves upward toward the head and the sensory nervous system, in the restricted sense of the term as I defined it earlier, combines with silicon to form silica, silicon dioxide. Carbon dioxide production is essential to the metabolic system, while internal production of silicon dioxide is essential to the sensory nervous system. The latter process, however, is too subtle to detect with our instruments, although methods are available that will eventually permit its detection. Thus, respiration consists of two processes: a cruder process that combines oxygen with carbon inside the organism, forming carbon dioxide, which is exhaled, and a more subtle process that combines oxygen with silicon to form silica, which is secreted into the human body. This secretion of silica transforms the entire human organism into a sense organ, to a greater extent on its periphery, and to a lesser extent in each internal organ. This view into the finer structure of the human organism shows us that each individual organ has and must have its own specific complement of substance-bound processes. We took silica as an example, but the same is true of countless other substances. If we want to understand health or illness, we must understand how these processes take place in a human organ. Let's take the kidneys as another example. Suppose the symptoms suggest that a disease originates in the kidneys. Applying spiritual science to diagnosis reveals that the kidneys are not functioning adequately as sense organs for the neighboring digestive and excretory processes. In this case, the metabolic function of the kidneys has become excessive, and the balance is disturbed. So the first thing we have to consider is how to strengthen the sensory function of the kidneys. In this case, we must make sure to supply the kidneys with the silica they need. Anthroposophy shows us that there are three ways of supplying the organism with substances necessary for health. The first method is by mouth, orally, giving a substance as if it were a food. In that case, however, we must wait and see whether the digestive system as a whole effectively transports the substance to where we want it to work. This method often works, but when we administer a substance by mouth into the digestive tract, we must know how it works in the human organism, whether it affects the heart, the lungs, and so forth. Injection, the second method, introduces the substance directly into the rhythmic system, where it works more as a process than as a substance, immediately transforming the substantial organization of the metabolism into rhythmic activity. In the third method, we attempt to work on the human organism from outside by applying topical preparations such as ointments or baths to the right part of the body. Thus, we have three methods of administering medicinal substances. Getting back to our diagnosis of reduced sensory capacity in the kidneys, we need to introduce the appropriate silica process. I described how one aspect of respiration combines oxygen with silicon and distributes it throughout the body. We must make this activity move more strongly in the direction of the kidneys. To do so, we must know how to come to the aid of an organism that cannot produce enough silica for the kidneys. Somewhere in the external natural world, we must recognize the process corresponding to what is lacking in the organs in question, in this case the kidneys. How do we find ways and means of guiding the silica process into the kidneys in particular? We discover that kidney function, especially inasmuch as it is also a sensory function, depends on the human astral body, which is the basis for the specific degenerative processes we call elimination. Therefore, we must introduce silica from outside and stimulate the astral body to guide it into the kidneys. We need a remedy that stimulates the silica process in the kidney in particular. When we look for such a remedy in the plant world, we discover Equisetum arvensa, the field-scouring rush. One characteristic of this plant is that it contains a great deal of silica. If we were to administer pure silica, it would not get to the kidneys. Equisetum also contains sulfates, however, which affect the rhythmic system and the organs of elimination, especially the kidneys. When sulfates are as closely associated with silica as they are in Equisetum arvensa, they smooth the way for silica to reach the kidneys. This remedy can be administered orally, or if that doesn't work, by either of the other methods. This individual example demonstrates the actual pathological activity in kidney disease. Our method of formulating the appropriate remedy was very precise. We looked for a substance to replace the missing process in the kidney. Step by clearly understandable step, we bridge the gap between diagnosis and treatment. Let's take another example. Suppose we are dealing with digestive symptoms such as indigestion. Using the spiritual, scientific procedure I have already described, we see that these symptoms are primarily due to a defective capital I being. But why isn't this member working strongly enough? We need to find the reason somewhere in the functioning of the human organism, and inadequate gall secretion is often a factor in such cases. Just as we used Equisetum to assist kidney function, we must now administer a remedy that supports the eye organization when it is not working strongly enough in gall secretion. Just as the silica process, which underlies normal sensory nervous activity, increases the sensory capability of the kidneys, if administered in the right way, specific carbon processes in the organism support functions like gall secretion that correspond primarily to the eye organization. Strangely enough, when we attempt to introduce carbon into the organism to counteract indigestion, we discover that the plant carbon in Sicorium intibus has a natural affinity for the gallbladder. By using a remedy prepared from Sicorium intibus in the right way, we can guide a specific carbon process into gall function, just as we guide a silica process into the kidneys by using an Equisetum preparation. I have attempted to use these easily surveyed examples, which can encompass both mild and serious illnesses, to demonstrate how the general principles of spiritual scientific insight into the human organism and natural substances and their interactions lead to an understanding of both disease processes and their reversal, thus transforming healing into a rational art. This is what medicine, the art of healing, stands to gain from the scientific research methods we call anthroposophy. There is nothing fantastical about these methods. They enhance the precision of our research so that we can clearly understand the entire human being from physical, psychological, and spiritual perspectives, because human sickness and health depend on the action of the physical body, the soul, and the spirit. By subdividing the human being into the sensory nervous system, the rhythmic system, and the metabolic limb system, we also gain insight into many different processes and their gradations. Once we are aware of the essence of sensory function, we learn to recognize the sensory function of the kidneys, for example, whereas formerly we saw only the cruder aspects of sensory activity. This new awareness allows us to clearly understand illnesses as such. I said earlier that the activity occurring in the metabolic limb system is the opposite of the sensory nervous process. But sensory nervous functions that normally take place in the nerves in the head can also shift to the metabolic limb system. In that case, a function that is normal and right in our sensory nervous organization is displaced and occurs in the metabolic limb system as a result of abnormalities of the astral body and I being. That is, a function appropriate to one system can cause illness when it is metamorphosed and affects a different system. For example, a disease develops in the sensory nervous system when a function belonging to another system appears there. This is what happens in typhoid fever. Typhoid fever is an activity that belongs in the nervous system and in our physical organization. When it moves into the etheric domain of the metabolic system, it is superimposed on the physical body and manifests as typhoid fever. This is an example of how we gain insight into the essential nature of a disease process. Similarly, the forces that create sense organs can also become active in the wrong place. That is, the activity underlying a sense organ can metamorphose and become active elsewhere. Let's take the example of the ear. If the functioning of the ear appears somewhere other than in the sensory nervous system, at a point where the metabolic system connects with the rhythmic system, for example, an abnormal tendency to develop a sense organ arises and manifests as carcinoma or cancer. We can recognize carcinomas as displaced tendencies toward the development of sense organs only when we clearly understand the structure and functioning of the human body in the anthroposophical sense. One of anthroposophy's most fruitful contributions to the field of medicine is the realization that abnormalities in the human organism are due to displaced functions that are normal in other systems. This insight into the human organism enables us to truly understand health and illness for the first time, and to bridge the gap between diagnosis and treatment, between observing illness and curing it. When the full context of these considerations is presented, none of the statements of spiritual science contradict modern medicine. An important first step in this direction will be the imminent publication of a book co-authored by myself and Dr. Ita Wegman, director of the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim. Footnote, this book was entitled Extending Practical Medicine, Fundamental Principles Based on the Science of the Spirit, Collected Works, Volume Number 27, end of footnote. This book, which attempts to present spiritual scientific perspectives on medicine as complementing rather than contradicting contemporary medicine, will convince you that spiritual scientific perspectives are not the mere fabrications they are reputed to be. In a way that will do full justice to contemporary science, This book will demonstrate the fruitful contributions of spiritual scientific research to the art of healing. As such, subjects are investigated in increasing detail and with scientific conscientiousness. The efforts of such facilities as the International Laboratories in Arlesheim, where a whole series of new remedies has been produced according to the principles outlined here, will be more generally acknowledged. The task of my third lecture will be to consolidate the rational basis of therapy that has already been suggested here by considering, at least to the extent that such things can be presented on a popular level, very specific individual cases of illness and possible cures. Those who clearly understand what is involved need not be concerned at the prospect of subjecting our suggestions to exact tests. We know that the popular response will be the same as the response to general anthroposophy. Initially, those unfamiliar with the details will criticize and cast aspersions, but their criticism will cease as they become familiar with the specifics. I will present details in the next lecture to demonstrate that the field of anthroposophical medicine intends to work in complete harmony with contemporary science rather than to circumvent it. Anthroposophy, however, also works out of the urge to complement modern science with spiritual insight. Only when these circumstances are understood will the art of healing find its true foundations. Because the art of healing deals with human beings, who are beings of body, soul, and spirit. Any true science of medicine must seek to understand the human being on this threefold basis. The end of Lecture 8.